Please support the Climate Change and Happiness podcast. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.
Welcome to Climate Change and Happiness, an international podcast that explores the personal side of climate change, your feelings, what the crisis means to you, and how to cope and thrive. And now, your hosts, Thomas Doherty and Panu Pikkala.
Well, hello, I'm Thomas Doherty.
And I am Panu Pikkala.
And welcome to Climate Change and Happiness. This is our podcast, the show for people around the globe who are thinking and feeling deeply about climate change and other environmental issues. And that's our main job, is to have a forum for people to tap into their emotions and their feelings and how this leads to our life and our well-being and our actions and things like that. It's a big topic, and we always try to find a place in it each episode. And we're really honored and glad to have a guest with us today.
Hello, everyone. It's wonderful to be with you, and it's always fun to see you, Panu and Thomas. My name is Lisa Van Susteren. I'm speaking to you from Washington, D.C. I am a general and forensic psychiatrist here focusing on climate and mental health.
And we're really, Panu and I have obviously know a lot about Lisa's work, and we've interacted with her in different ways. Lisa, I knew of you for a long time, and then we connected a few years ago. I'm not entirely sure exactly how it happened, but you know, one of the benefits of getting into this work is you do eventually meet really interesting, gifted people. And I know I'm personally interested in hearing a bit about your experience at the Montana trial last year, and various things. But we'll keep going on things. And I know you and Panu have collaborated on stuff. We'll hear about some of your current projects. So yes, Panu, do you want to get us started?
Warmly welcome, Lisa. Also on my behalf, lovely to meet you again. And I first read some of your writing when doing studies about climate change and mental health impacts in the late 2010s. So there was the concept of working wounded, for example, and a rather influential report that you participated in writing in early 2010s, but later we've had the privilege to cooperate with Caroline Hickman and others in the Lancet's Youth Climate Anxiety Study. And I know that you have been involved in a lot of organizations and efforts to make the world better. But what we haven't talked about actually is how you first got into environmental and climate matters. So would you like to share something of your journey? How did it happen that you became so intensively involved in these matters?
Well, that's, obviously an important question for anyone. And sometimes I look back at it and think to myself, well, was I doing that because I was predisposed, or did the conditions around me create it? I'll back up to say that my grandfather, who was a doctor as well, was a key figure in cleaning up the Finger Lakes in upstate New York. And so he was known as an environmental, I never met him, but he was known as an environmental creature, so to speak. And then the key issue really for me was when I ran for office. I ran for the U.S. Senate here in Maryland. And my issues at the time, it was 2005, were the our invasion of Iraq, and also healthcare. And it was during that time that I really began to focus more on climate issues and grew increasingly aware of the depth and scope of the problem. And when I obviously did not prevail in the election, I really knew there was a moment at a breakfast when someone was talking about the next industrial revolution and how we were going to need to harness nature in new and different ways, that I said to myself, if this doesn't work out, the campaign, I know where I'm going next. And that's exactly what happened. And I will also credit the fact, because Al Gore deserves this credit. He had called for the training in the Climate Reality Project, and I was one of the first 50 trained in Carthage at his farm. And so, you know, he launched this huge family of climate reality members, and we're still seeing each other and still helping each other.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, there's micro generations, I think, in climate change work, you know, depending on when people came into it. And I'll often have people line up and just say, what year did you become aware and stuff? And so, yes, that 2009 is similar for me when I was on the American Psych Association Climate Task Force and things like that. That's when all this started to become much more real. But also, Lise, I know in your background, you've volunteered around the world, and you also did your medical studies in Europe. What was that aspect of your life like?
Well, with due apologies to all Wisconsinites, I love Wisconsin. I love the down-to-earth aspect of Wisconsin. But I was from a small town in Wisconsin, and Paris loomed. And, you know, it's sort of like Appleton, Wisconsin, Paris, France. Mm-hmm. So I actually went over there on a lark and, of course, fell in love. And then when I decided that I wanted to go to medical school, I said, I'm going back to Paris. And I didn't really know how to speak French, but, you know, classes are in science early on, and you didn't have to know much conversational French. So back I went, and so I stayed there for a decade. And you know what? Here's the good thing. Honestly, the whole time I was there, I knew, boy, this is one good gig. So I did enjoy it, take advantage of the fact that it was really fun and beautiful and exciting in the sense that every day you were not only feeding your mind by learning certainly your medical studies, but you could watch people and learn expressions. And it made everyone and everything so interesting because the language was so new.
Yeah. So you're a bit of a cosmopolitan then in this regard, like you've a cultural cosmopolitan person. And do you feel that translates into the climate work, you know, knowing different cultures?
I never thought of that. I will say that those days have come to an end because I don't like to get on airplanes. If it's for family or for health reasons, I get on airplanes. But I have a hard time. But I never thought to myself that maybe my travels would have sensitized me. It's possible because I went from France traveled through Europe, obviously living there for 10 years. Then I went, instead of coming back to the States, I went to Africa and I worked as a doctor in Africa. And I never really thought of that, Thomas, but I think it did sensitize me to something very, very different from the bubble that I live in, frankly, here in Washington, D.C., in the neighborhood that I live in.
That's fascinating. And of course, both of you were writing about the psychological effects of climate change already at a time when the physical impacts were not so strong in the United States. Mm-hmm. So one could speculate that having experiences in various parts of the globe might help to sensitize one to think about and feel about what it is like in other countries.
Yeah.
No, I think also I'll acknowledge this to your listeners because it probably will resonate. No one has a perfect childhood. I had much to be grateful for. But I think I was either born or else I was, because of various situations, made more aware of trauma. Mm-hmm. And so the sensitization early in life can sometimes mean that you are going to be more attuned to suffering just because there's a resonance in you. And I think that there's some truth to that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's issue. We have issues and issues. We have the big issues we want to work on in the world and the little issues that we carry inside of us. And part of that insight, I think, leads to our long-term coping, right?
Yeah, and some of the work that we do on the outside is inner repair that we're not entirely conscious of. But we're fighting against feelings of abandonment, of loss, of fear, of grief, of anger, et cetera, despair. To someone who knows those feelings perhaps early in life, and maybe it's constitutional that we feel them as powerfully, but they don't just go away, but it can serve as a platform, obviously, to our sensitivity to others and the willingness to work.
Mm. Thanks for sharing that, Lisa. I think that's very profound and great that you speak about it openly some people talk about trauma-informed approaches where the personal experience shapes how one sees things. And many of the most profound books on climate emotions are also written by people who have trauma history. So it's of course wonderful if that kind of survivor mission or whatever we call it can happen. So in addition to all the trouble it can generate for people, there's sometimes profound sensitivities, I think. So thanks for sharing that.
Agreed. And it brings us together, knowing that we have that in common. And it can also help us. Sometimes I get frustrated with people around me who seem to be a bit oblivious. And I have to understand that people are different. We're all made a little bit different. And so if we sense things, feel things, and are focused on things, it's our job to try to figure out how to bring it in a constructive way to others, not to do what I sometimes think. I've got I imagine a 2x4 behind me, and I think to myself, okay, I'm going to go in and pound these people into submission, because I get very frustrated and restless. And we have to remind ourselves that people have different life experiences, a different constitution. It's up to us to be the good messengers.
Yeah. There's so much we could talk about, but let's make sure we talk about the Montana trial. Among your work, Lisa, I'm guessing that when history looks back, that the particular you're testifying and it's hard to know how things are going to break, you know, regarding climate change and the laws and the legal, all the different legal challenges and things that are happening. But you got a chance to testify at a pretty historic trial here in the U.S. in Montana last year. As people might know, many parts of the world, there have been legal efforts to legislate about climate change sponsored by young people or groups that are working on behalf of young people and the younger generation, right? The novel that came out a few years ago, the Ministry for the Future, right? Kim Stanley Robinson. So people have been doing that kind of idea that we have to stand for future generations. And so anyway, those trials have typically, like all the legal stuff, it's slow, and people who don't want change are, as everyone knows, can easily, you know, slow the works of all the legal efforts in many, many ways. So most of those trials are thrown out for technicalities and things. But this case went to trial in the state of Montana, a very kind of red, conservative, outdoorsy, resourcey kind of state, but also a very outdoors-minded state. In the U.S., I think most people would feel super intimidated to be testifying at a trial like that. But given your background and your style, I think you really rose to the occasion. But what was it like? What was it like in that experience?
Well, first of all, I am a forensic psychiatrist, so it is expected that I would be willing to go into a courtroom. But willing was hardly the word here. It was I'm going to say, what a relief it was. To be sitting, it was a country courtroom, really, wood paneled, and it had such an intimate atmosphere. And, you know, it became a bigger issue once it left the doors of the courtroom with reporters, et cetera. But there, it felt like we were all together among people who were, for me at least, willing to listen. There was a judge who sat there quietly taking notes. There were certainly family members and the plaintiffs and court reporter, et cetera, and of course, the lawyers. I have to say that Montana did not distinguish itself with their lawyers, and that's just the fact. They were not terribly well prepared. Our lawyers were very well prepared. And frankly, my testimony was the culmination of everything I've been feeling for the last decade, but said in a very disciplined way. Mm-hmm. So what was it like for me? Yeah, I was wired. I was like a panther in a cage, walking up and down the hallway of the B&B that I rented, and finally had to leave and go to the hotel because I was with a friend of mine, but I realized I was driving her kind of crazy because I kept imagining all of the questions that the other side was going to ask me and what my 1-2 punch was going to be. So when I was sitting there in the witness box, I can't tell you what it was like to feel as if I was finally saying something that people had to listen to, and that there was going to be a winner or a loser, a very specific outcome. It wasn't just trying to pound something into somebody. There was going to be a coda. There was going to be an up or down. So it was a relief.
That's really, really neat to see. So it's intimate, but you've been building up to that experience for years since 2000. Well, since your training with Al Gore.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. We had the facts on our side. We had the courtroom on our side with the kids and their parents. We had the high moral ground. We were talking about corporations versus kids who were up on the stand crying. I mean, you do the math. Talk about feeling like you were on the winning team. It was really exciting to feel as if finally people had to listen. And, you know, so often we've given talks and people come up to us afterwards and say, oh, good job, you know. But you think, well, you know, are the carbon emissions going down now? A greenhouse gas is going down? So here you could say to yourself, there's going to be a decision, and this really could affect the numbers. So there was, as I say, this sense that was very empowering for all of us.
Mm-hmm. It also sounds like there was a kind of sense of honor in defending such a righteous cause.
Sure, yes, yes. Although the fire in my belly, finally, it felt like I could get the flames out. And I knew that once the questions that were posed to me by our lawyers were finished, that the other side was going to come in. And I thought, come on, guys, come on, I'm ready for you. I have imagined every question you can think of. And I was just waiting for my 1-2 punch. And I have to say, this is a parenthetical, that I was sort of disappointed. They asked me about 3 questions. They didn't want to touch me. Mm-hmm. I had been, you know, those nights going back and forth, stalking them in my mind. They stayed away. But there was that sense that you were going to be able to knock them and put them on the ropes. And that is very satisfying. You know, we have felt as if people aren't always listening and as if we don't have the power to do what needs to be done. And for those glowing minutes, it was a very different experience.
There's recognition and validation, and somebody is really listening. And it also sounds like you were able to channel moral outrage, and in this case, climate anger, into determination and preparedness. So not aggression in the classical sense, but a more constructive defending of rights and borders.
I'm going to try to remember that. Yes, the moral outrage finally could be mustered and released. But I will also say that our Children's Trust lawyers are amazing. They are dedicated. They know so well what they're doing. They prepared me well. Everything was very carefully gone through, not scripted, but gone through. So, you know, we also know how important preparation is. But you are right. It was the moral outrage finally finding release.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've got the emotional task of this work, the descriptive task, understanding it, and then the prescriptive, you know, what to do. And you all were able to bring all of those together effectively. A lot of people, it was constructive moral outrage. If you had just gotten up there and ranted without having good data and an actionable kind of outcome that you were offering, it wouldn't have gone as well. So
let me say, Tom, sir, was a very specific issue. The Montana legislature and then the governor signed legislation which prohibited state agencies from considering, when they went about assessing an environmental project, they were enjoined, they were prevented from considering the impacts of climate change on an environmental project. So it was in direct conflict with the Montana Constitution, which said that Montanans, and this is what's worth noting, is this amendment to the Constitution took place in 1972 because a couple of enterprising people said, you know, we should do this. It tells us that we can't always see the benefit of what we're doing, uh-huh. but doing the right thing is always a good thing to do. And what they did was they had an amendment to the Constitution that said that all Montana residents had the right to a clean and healthful environment. And that was what the entire case revolved around, that the legislature and the governor had violated the constitutional rights of Montana citizens. So thank you to the people 50 years ago who had the foresight. And it should be a reminder to all of us to always try to be doing the right thing. We don't always know the outcome, but sometimes it can be key.
Yeah, that's really key. And there are so few, in the United States anyway, there are so few laws that directly protect nature or the natural world, or certainly a right to a clean environment. I actually now have to look and see where else those are in the States, but that clearly came out of the...
Well, those, it's called a green constitution, and New York has a green constitution. Pennsylvania has a sort of a green constitution, I believe, and so does Hawaii. And our next case, by the way, is in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. Is that also filed by children in Hawaii or what?
Yes, it is. Well, that's the magic power card, isn't it? Having children on a stand, acknowledging what it's doing to them. I think we can, as policymakers, get embedded in a sort of intellectual sphere, and we forget what's happening to people on the ground. And those kids go up there and they say, my house burned down, my house washed away. I'm afraid of the future. I don't want to have kids. You hear that and it breaks through the natural defense to make this some kind of an intellectual endeavor. This is real.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's very, very profound. And because it's a legal case, it also helps with the temporality. What I mean is that in well-meaning environmental conferences for a long time, there's been moving testimonies by indigenous people and children and other folks who suffer. But if it's only that in itself, very moving speech, then it can be sort of ritualized and sometimes even tokenized, I fear. But then if it's a legal court case, it doesn't go away. We can't just leave it behind as a single event.
It becomes a springboard.
Yeah.
For action.
Yeah. So a takeaway from listeners, you know, is like what we're hearing, like from Lise, you know, you never do know how your actions, even generations earlier, will affect the future. So it is important to act. I think all of us, I mean, everywhere we live, anywhere your listeners, the listeners are, U.S. or Canada or the UK or anywhere in the world, checking what does your state, town, area have a green constitution of some form. I know where I live in Portland, Oregon, the city has a lot of rules that are explicitly looking at nature and climate and things like that. And so that is, it's something to take solace, because I think a lot of people don't. They just feel alone and they feel like nothing is happening and no one is doing anything. But that's just really not true. At least, as you well know, there are people doing things all over the place. And so we have to break through that kind of illusion that nothing is being done.
You know, Thomas, I think of it as, how does a South Pacific island get created? There's volcanic action under the water for a long, long time. And every time there's another eruption, there's more lava that forms underneath the waves. And then finally there's an eruption and there it is, above sea level. But before we see it bursting through the surface of the water, there's a lot of work being done on the ground. And I think we should be thinking this all the time.
That's a great image, yeah. Yeah, Yeah, I use that with therapy clients sometimes. Just they're looking at a pyramid, but they're not looking at the whole pyramid. Their problem is this piece. But you remind them, look at all the other stuff that you've been doing, or any project that someone's working on. They're always focused on what's not done. You know, with my writing, I keep reminding myself, what about all this other stuff you've already done? So it's a good reminder.
Yeah, you know, I'm guilty of that myself. You didn't do this and you didn't do that. I'm thinking of professional organizations that I get so restless with. I can understand the restlessness, but you're right. It is so very important to recognize that so many people are doing so many things now, and you just can't see it until it reaches a certain percent. Just like there are climate tipping points, there are social tipping points. And we're building to those social tipping points, but we may not see it until that last bean is put on the scale and boom.
Yeah, yeah. I want to mention something while we have time coming toward the end of our time, but just in practicalities, Lise, you being a psychiatrist and me being a psychologist, and Panu, you being an academic that takes part in a lot of organizations and conferences, I think a cutting edge for me is even just working on the American Psychological Association that I'm a member of and their convention that happens every year. And I think that's one place where mental health providers can actually advocate, not only for the government and things like Montana, but in their own organizations, because many mental health organizations are starting to talk about climate and environmental issues. So that is a plus. The American Psychological Association, American Psychiatric Association have done this for years, which is a plus and that should be applauded. But their conferences still have huge carbon footprints. And I know, at least for the APA, the American Psych Association, which I've been advocating for, there's no mention of climate change in the convention prospectus for Seattle. So they're inviting all these people to come to Seattle. So there's a disconnect in our professional groups between our rhetoric and our knowledge about climate and mental health and what the actual organization does itself.
Thomas, I got to tell you, my husband says I got an answer for everything. I simply cannot understand what in the world isn't happening in the minds of people who are involved in, and I say American Psychological predated American Psychiatric. James, I can't remember his last name, but he was the head of the American Psychological Association, and in 2009 came to a conference, a meeting that I had on the effects of global warming and why the U.S. mental health care system is not prepared. Psychological was way ahead.
Yeah.
And so I don't understand what they don't see that we see.
Yeah, I think it was James Bray, I think, was the president. Yeah.
James Bray, that's it. Yes. James Bray, thank you. He was from Texas. Wonderful guy. Came. I tried at the American Psychiatric, and they said that people were busy. And I said, well, then send the staff. And they said, no one's interested. And I thought, well, maybe you'll be interested when you're having to put on scuba diving equipment to get to your sixth floor office. I don't know. I know I'm getting a little edgy there, but I don't understand. I don't have an answer for it because I said the same thing to a colleague. I looked at what is going on at the American Psychiatric in New York, and they're highlighting all these issues, but not climate.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's great that you both produce creative disruption to that kind of intentional blindness or having blinkers, and instead of association, practicing some kind of efforts at dissociation, even while a topic of a session might be climate change. But then let's not think about this in relation to the structure and the procedures, for example. But Lisa, I don't even start to mention the names of all the climate-related organizations that you have been taking part in. There's a very recent effort called Ecopsychopedia, which was just launched last week when we are recording this. And that's something that I wanted to offer you the opportunity, if you want to say a few words about that.
Sure. Thank you. And thank you for the absolution for my riff. So EcoSci, which is the nickname, because EcoPsychopedia, as it turns out, people are saying EcoPsycho. And while that might be more appropriate in some instances, it's psyche. So EcoSci is a wiki-like collection of articles. And this came about, and this is what I want to really emphasize with people. Start anywhere where you think, where your heart takes you. We started off with about 25 people interested in potentially putting together a slideshow on climate and mental health that was sort of a library, a la An Inconvenient Truth. Not that we were competing with it, but we thought that's where we would go. Well, it evolved into what is has become EcoSci, which is, as I say, a wiki-like collection of articles related to climate and mental health. And we have several dozen articles now. Panu contributed one. We're very grateful, and it's an excellent one. And there's a format, and we welcome people to present a thought about what a person might want to contribute. We welcome writers and people who are experts. This is essentially self-run volunteers by a half a dozen of us. We have one editorial manager, but what it's going to do is it make readily available information in one place. So you don't have to have a PhD in research and 6 weeks to look stuff and find only that the work you're trying to get to is behind a paywall or the material is outdated, etc. This is a place where we can quickly, journalists, media types, policymakers, the interested lay public, can quickly get an idea about a particular topic. And we assume that it will grow and evolve. And we will update it frequently. So that's EcoSci. And then there's a book, much like the same model. It's an e-book, just like EcoSci is online. It will have the sort of chapter version of many of the topics that are in EcoSci. So climate in your mind, it's for everybody. It is a product of the, I often think of it as the town hall, where we can talk about these things to each other, with each other, and with others. So everyone is welcome.
Yeah, and we're going to put a link to that. It's really coming together now. So yes, there's so much. We're going to wrap it up here. This was a great conversation. There's so much to talk about. But the takeaway is there's much that has been done. There's much to celebrate. And there's more to do. That splitting that Panu mentioned, you know, where we have the reality of something on one hand and the actions. That's normal because the making change in society is very hard. It's very hard. And so we do have to work in our families and in our organizations, and it's slow. But it is like that volcano. We keep pushing until we break through the surface. We just have to be faster than the rising sea, I guess, with our volcano, that metaphor that I'll close with here.
Yeah, well, Thomas, I'll just say that in just a few years ago, I could shut a dinner party down in seconds, and sometimes would. I'd fight with myself for a while, and then I'd give in to the impulse. And now, when I bring up climate, it's a completely different picture. People get it. We just have to get our policymakers now in office, the right people in office, and then I think the dam will break loose. And we'll have this transition, and we can all work together to sustain it.
Well said. Well, thank you, Lisa. I want to thank you for all your work and inspiration. And Panu, it's always great to spend time with you. And listeners, I hope you got something great out of our discussion, and we wish you all well. Everyone, take care.
Take care.
Thank you.
Warm thanks, Lisa.
The Climate Change and Happiness podcast is a self-funded volunteer effort. Please support us so we can keep bringing you messages of coping and thriving. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.